Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Big Ticket, Variety and iHeart's movie podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. This week, I sit down with Lee Pace. The Emmy-nominated actor opens up about growing up queer, but first we talk about his portrayal of John DeLorean in DeLorean, a new biopic about the late automobile mogul. We also talk about a possible Pushing Daisies reunion, his work as Ronan in the MCU, and what happened when he and his boyfriend recently realized they were eating at the same restaurant as one of the young stars of Euphoria. I have that and a whole lot more coming up after the break. Stick around. Welcome back. Here's Lee Pace. So how are you?
Pretty good.
Mr.
Pretty
Lee
good.
Pace, thank you for stopping by.
Yeah, I mean, swallow my gum.
Swallow your gum.
I've got it. There, no, I choked it down.
I do the same thing.
Yeah, I'm sure I've got a big ball of gum in my stomach that I've been collecting since I was in high school.
So let's talk about Driven. John DeLorean. What did you know? I think we all think we know something about John DeLorean. What did you know beforehand?
Well, I mean, I really only knew about the car
right
before I started work on him. And I guess you're right. I had a sense of, you know, a scandal. You know, there was, I had a very unclear idea of who the man was who made that car.
Right.
Yeah, when I dove into the research on him, I mean, he's just an enigmatic person who everyone's got a different story about. You know, who he was.
And it's not really clear who he was. I mean, at least the movie, it's sort of like, okay, was he in on this? Was he not? I'm not going to talk about, I'll talk about something at the end so people could like turn this off because I don't want to spoil it because I have a very big question and I don't want to spoil it. But so tell me, how does the research begin with someone like that? He's not alive anymore.
Well, I mean, but the research began for me on the book he wrote himself, or had ghostwritten. But you know, with someone like this, you really can't believe anything they say about themselves, nor anything other people say about them, because he's such a kind of legendary person and enjoyed creating the legend about himself.
Right.
He had designed the GTO and the Firebird, and he was, you know, going up the ranks at GMC, and could have, you know, run GMC, and he decided to go off on his own and create DeLorean Motor Company.
And he was young.
Yeah, he was young. Yeah. I mean, but he was, I mean, I think one of the first in this kind of modern age of celebrity CEOs, you know,
right,
which is such a specific idea of branding,
you know? We could really get into that.
Yeah, we could. But it's like, yeah, creating a brand around your name and your personality. And, you know, he enjoyed doing that. He enjoyed creating that and kind of saw the money inside it too. I think when it comes down to it, you know, aside from all that, he designed incredible cars. And he had, and not only that, he's, you know, invented things that are in all the cars that we drive today.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Certain ways the engines function, the airbags, that was something he developed.
In the movie, when he said to Jim, he's like, oh, have you heard about airbags?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's right, airbags didn't always exist.
Yeah, and like and manufacturing the cars using computers in the way that, you know, it's done now in a very common way. But back in the early 80s, that was really cutting-edge technology.
Right.
They were trying to figure out how to, you know, produce cars in a you know, in a bigger way like they do now. So, you know, none of that stuff is the interesting stuff in this movie. The really interesting stuff in this movie is kind of what you can believe about this person and what you can't, because it's about the relationship between him and Jim Hoffman, who is his neighbor in the house they had in outside San Diego in Puma Valley, and this kind of situation they found themselves in.
Yeah, so how does a man like John DeLorean, who's obviously, you know, a genius at what he does, at least parts of it, he's a smart guy, how does he get involved with this guy Jim, who's just like this sort of two-bit criminal?
Well, I think John is working on this huge project that's taking him all over the world. You know, he's going to, I mean, there was a chance they were trying to get the project together in the United States. That wasn't possible, so they tried Puerto Rico, and then they managed to cut a deal with the British government to build a factory in Northern Ireland. And so if he was traveling all over the world trying to, collect the pieces he needed to make this car. But the place he really liked to be was this house that he owned in Poma Valley. Mm. It's this, you know, comfortable, you know, nice house. And one of his neighbors was Jim Hoffman. And he would have parties at the house. And he, I think, one thing is undeniable to me about John is that he loved life. He loved his life. Mm-hmm. You know, he loved his family. He loved interesting people. He loved interesting famous people. But he also just loved interesting people, right. You know. And Jim was one of his neighbors. Their kids played together. Mm-hmm. Which also means they sat by the pool and drank beer together. Mm-hmm. While their kids played together. So that's how we got to know this guy. That's how we figured it out in the movie, that he knows this guy. And I think the way they connected is that they're not really people who are interested in following rules, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that there was a common thread that they found just a disdain for the way things, you know, people who follow rules having to follow rules that they didn't write.
And what I found interesting throughout the movie, there are parts where you're really rooting for John DeLorean. Mm-hmm. Then there are parts of, like, he'll just do this look and you're like, oh my God, this guy has no scruples. Mm-hmm. He doesn't care. He's going to do whatever it takes to succeed. So I couldn't figure out if he was a nice guy, bad guy. I guess it's just a mixture of all of it.
I mean, I don't know anyone who's just a nice guy or just a bad guy. You know, I think he's a fascinating guy. But when I think about, because I listen to these, you know, there are these really interesting recordings of meetings that he was, as he's designing this car. When you're designing a car like this, you're debating so many different things. The cost of a plate that will go under the gas tank, right. You know, that for every car that cost mounts, but it's a safety measure that you either choose to take or you don't choose to take. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it's not up to me, but in the final analysis, I think he's a pretty exceptional guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he's an innovator and someone who puts new ideas out into our world, and that's a pretty cool thing. Not everyone can do that.
Right. And then the big question was whether, so basically what happens is he needs money mm-hmm. to finance his company. He tries to do it through a drug deal. Mm-hmm. And now the question was whether he initiated the deal or he was entrapped. And the movie doesn't give a clear answer, and I don't know, do we ever find out a clear answer?
The case went to trial,
right.
And his lawyer was able to prove that this was an entrapment, that this wasn't something that he initiated, right. But something that had been constructed around him. And there's lots of theories, you know, if you talk to DeLorean people about why that was the case. Mm-hmm. This factory in Northern Ireland was very, very expensive to the English government, right. And Margaret Thatcher had just gotten into power. Mm-hmm. So I doubt she was too pleased about spending that money on cars, right. That were being shipped over to America, to the American market. So who knows actually what really happened? You know, whoever knows what actually happens in these things? Right. You know, you kind of you understand the version that is agreed upon at the end of it, but who knows what happens as they were, you know, sitting by the pool drinking beers, you know. But he did have to come up with a chunk of money to keep the company floating.
A lot of money
in the early 80s, you know, a lot of money. And he chose to do it this way, which I think says a lot about who he is, you know, to be in this situation. Because the fact is he was involved in this drug deal. Right. He was sitting there in that room looking at the suitcase full of coke and thinking, right. Well, that's how I'm going to get the money I need to plug the hole so I can, you know, do a line of the cars that have more colors in them, you know, then maybe it can appeal to a different, you know, other parts of the market. So they can just, maybe I can use the engine that I want to use as opposed to the engine that I had to use for manufacturing purposes. You know, there's, I think there are versions of this car that were in his head that we never got to see.
Right.
And that's what he was fighting to get, kind of put out into the world.
And famous for saying, you wouldn't buy a used car from me, would you?
Yeah.
But But see, I feel like...
But even towards the end of the line, he was still... No, he was still trying to get...
Right,
because... Yeah, he was still designing cars. He was still, you know, trying to keep the business going. That's, you know... I admire him. I like him. I think he's cool, you know?
Did you try to get in touch with anyone who knew him?
It's amazing how many people had, you know, encounters with John DeLorean. And
what's the most interesting story you heard?
Well, I let other people tell the stories that you know, firsthand stories. I need to really kind of go through my notes about that. I mean, the general feeling I had was that people were pretty dazzled by him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, were pretty impressed by the presence of who he was.
I mean, he looked like a movie star.
Yeah, and yeah. I think he could, and I think he just had this force of charisma, mm-hmm. and you know, just presence about him that people believed in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he had and he was capable of a lot. He was capable of not only designing these very complicated machines that, you know, needed to be safe, needed to be reliable, mm-hmm. needed to, you know, take people from A to B. Sometimes that distance is very far.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an easy thing to do, you know, and that's, we all put our faith. I don't know. I know simply, you know, the basic way a car operates, but I don't know how my car operates.
They're so complicated
now.
It's like when I was a kid and my dad would do things on the car, like, you know, change the oil. I wouldn't know how to change the oil in my car.
Yeah.
It's also, I have an electric car, so I guess I don't have
to change it. Yeah, like the other electric cars, it's all computers now. I know basic things about them, but I don't know how they run now. And so there's a lot of moving parts in creating a machine like that and making it affordable so that we can all buy it, you know. And he's been a part of that. Not to the sum total of John DeLorean is not this story. It's, you know, the creating the GTO, creating like putting a big engine in a smaller, you know, car. That's the idea of a muscle car. Right. That's, there's a glamour to that. Yep. That
it still is. I mean, all those cars, we still get excited when we see them.
Yeah.
So tell me about getting into character, literally the wardrobe, the hair. I mean, that you have to walk differently when you're, you know, it's the early 80s. It's sort of the end of the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself playing lots of characters where I look very different than myself. And you get, you know, when you're trying to get into character, you're thinking, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, maybe walk like this, or, you know, I'm going to find, you know, these gestures are interesting to me. But then you, the pieces come together and it kind of does it for you. Like the way people behave around you does it for you. That's what I found with him. I mean, the clothes are so specific.
So specific. And the dancing and the music.
Yeah. It's so specific. And that hair, I mean, it's like, that's so.
What's it like when they put, you know, do they just plop that wig on you? Do they check different wigs? Because the hair is almost iconic. Because that's what I was a kid when all of this went down, but I remember the white hair.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the hair was something. I mean, when Nick called me about playing the part initially, I was like, I don't know, Nick. I'm 20 years kind of too young to play this guy. I mean, our eyebrows are kind of similar, but beyond that, it's we're both kind of tall. But
was he 6'5"?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He was very, very, yeah. And like sturdy man, you know?
So you put that wig on.
Yeah. So we tried the wig out. We tried to do a chin too. So I've got the pictures I have of that makeup test. Thank God we decided against doing that chin, because it would have been a very different movie.
He was famous for having plastic surgery and giving himself a chin.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess people really called him
more of a chin.
Well, I was gonna give. I felt like I wanted to change the way my face looked in a way that ultimately it's like it just became a distraction.
Right.
You know, it was just it was, you know, one thing too much. But you know, Nick was game in letting me kind of explore that avenue, but the pictures are pretty ridiculous. I mean, it was like this. I looked like, I want to say one of those Hanna-Barbarian Barbera villains in the that great race.
Yeah.
Tell me about the Johnny Carson voice. Is that really Johnny Carson's voice?
Oh, you'll have to ask Nick. I don't know if that's actually Johnny Carson's. I'm sure they... Is that... Do you know if it's Johnny Carson's voice?
Yeah.
I don't...
I mean, it sounded like him. And I'm like, did they spice stuff together? But...
They were friends. You know, that's a moment that really happened. Johnny did kick in some investment money.
Wow.
But that car was a lemon. Those first cars that came off were unreliable.
Right.
They didn't, and they were, you know, not everyone could fix them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the downfall, was that they didn't perform quite as well. They didn't go as fast as, you know, as quickly as he said they would. And, that's one of my favorite moments in the movie, because I think it kind of shows John's showmanship.
Right now, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Lee talks about being a part of the MCU and gives us an update on a possible Pushing Daisies reunion. He also opens up and gets candid about growing up queer and what he learned about himself after playing a closeted Mormon in the Tony-winning revival of Angels in America. Stick around. Now, more of Lee Pace. So let's talk about a different role that's completely different than John DeLorean.
Mm-hmm.
Ronan. I mean, you're in that superhero world.
I know, it's so different. I mean, I'm a proper alien.
like you're blue. Like,
I'm
you're
blue.
Not just an alien, you're a blue alien.
Yeah, but alien warlord, accuser. that's a pretty fun turn of events in my career.
So I was at Comic-Con, mm-hmm. and they announced the MCU for basically the next 50 years or so with all their plans. Will we see Ronan come back?
I don't know. I'd be happy if they asked me back, because I love being a part of the MCU. I love playing that character.
Why is that?
Here's what I find so fun about the MCU is that they've created an environment where actually anything can happen. Anything can happen.
Mm-hmm.
The story can go into space. The story can go back in time. The story can, it's like actually anything can happen, you know?
That's right. You know, when things will happen at the MCU and someone's like, well, that can't happen. But I'm like,
it just did.
Like, we're not talking about real rules here.
Yeah. I think that freedom is creative, you know, just creatively interesting, you know, and that it connects to the audience in such a profound way. I enjoy the movies. It's a fun ride to be a part of.
It's pretty amazing too. I mean, obviously we cover the MCU a lot here at Variety. And the diversity and inclusivity that the MCU is doing, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I've learned a lot more, you know, studying Stan Lee, and Stan Lee was all about diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that works in the superhero world?
Gosh, what a great question. Because it has to work, you know? I mean, I think the superhero world that we live in today, but I guess that's not the case. It's always been, you know, a part of what Marvel has done, but... it's certainly what I think people are interested in seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that the narrow view that existed in the past in that movie world, you know, it just doesn't, it's not interesting. You know, it's not
how interesting is it in the sense of you do have, you know, MCU or whatever, any movie that's, or TV shows, and it's all about representation, it's all about diversity, and then you have this apparent sector of the country that doesn't want to see any diversity. Is the political fights causing the art to react?
Well, I think so because I think, you know, when it comes down to it, this is storytelling, and this it's like a direct line back to sitting by the campfire,
right,
and telling stories and exchanging values.
People want stories. They want to hear human stories.
They want to hear human stories, and they use those stories to exchange their values. Mm-hmm. You know, when you tell a joke, there's an exchange of values about this is really what I see in the world. You know, if you tell a joke about a greedy person, then the point of view is we don't like that guy, right? Like that guy's greedy. Let's stay away from him. You know, let's keep him away from power. You know, let's make sure he doesn't get to the meat before everyone else. And so when you see Marvel telling these stories, it's about their creativity, but it's also about that conversation that's happening and. Mm. It's resonating with so many people, not just in America, but around the world.
Right.
I mean, we live in a global world now.
Yeah.
It's no longer just an American conversation. It's a global conversation, and therefore a diverse one. And I think it's an awfully exciting time to be alive, to see all that, you know, it's a privilege to be a part of that conversation taking place.
So will we see a Pushing Daisies reboot, reunion, something?
I would love to see that.
Kristen Chenoweth just said it the other day.
What did she say?
She wants it.
Well, me and Brian are always scheming about it. Whenever we see each other, we're like, oh, God, wouldn't it be great to get the gang back together and do something? I think he's got a really fun idea for the story.
Oh, so you got, okay, come on, tell me.
I can't say, no, he's the storyteller. He's the storyteller, but we'd have to get everyone together. It would be so fun to do it, though.
Why do people love this? My husband that show so much. When I told him I was interviewing you today.
Oh, that means so much to me. Tell him thank you for me. I had such a great day. It was such a great time in my life when I shot it.
Why is that?
I don't know. It was just, I moved out to LA to do it. And it was, I mean, I drove onto the Warner Brothers lot every day, like right on gate 2 with those like palm trees and the studios going through. So it was just such a privilege to be a part of it. And like, Ned was a good character. I mean, it's like, couldn't be more different than Ronan the Accuser, to be honest. I mean, it's like, you go home feeling good when you play a character like Ned. Anna Friel, getting to look into her eyes and play that love story was just so much fun. Yeah, it was great. It was really creative and it was a show, I think, that, you know, you really felt like anything could happen.
Right.
I remember doing press for that show right when we were trying to launch it and trying to explain people the rules of Ned's powers. That he could touch a dead person back to life, but if they live for longer than a minute, then someone else died. And if they touch them a second time, then they died for good. Did I get that right? I think that's about
something like that, yes. You're still trying to
I'm still trying to like figure out the way.
I mean, you've been part of these cultural zeitgeist moments. I mean, I think people forget you were in Twilight.
Yeah,
Twilight.
That was a fun one too.
I mean, that's covering the Twilight phenomenon.
Yeah,
and it's still not over.
Is it? What do you mean?
It's just the Twi fans are still out there. They're still obsessed with the movies.
Yeah, that was so fun. I made friends for life on that one. Because we shot that big battle scene in this ag barn in Baton Rouge. Most of the year they would use this space to auction cattle. But they covered it with this big white piece of cloth or something. And then for months we were standing there in the snow, standing off against the...
Looking very pale.
Looking very pale in our contacts. And that was fun. Yeah, that was like this insane kind of portion of my career where I went from doing that to going to New Zealand to play The Elf King and The Hobbit, and then going to London to do Ronan the Accuser. So it was...
That's a lot of makeup.
It was a lot of it. I mean, it was a vampire, an elf, and an alien, kind of all in this chunk of time.
But then Angels in America. I saw you in Angels in America.
Oh, did you see it? Oh, thanks so much for checking that out.
My husband and I went specifically to New York to make sure we saw it before.
Oh, wow. Did you see it all in one day?
One day.
Yeah, that was the way to do it.
I can't even, I have so many questions about it. Just doing that all in one day, how did you sort of go home at night and just go, ugh?
It was the most confronting, difficult experience I've ever had doing this job.
Why is that?
Doing that play. Well, it's that play. It's the play that Tony wrote. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I get chills now. Look, I'm getting goosebumps.
You are.
Just even thinking about the experience of playing that character. Because I've never had an experience like Joe Pitts. You know, don't have the mother he had. I didn't grow up in the religion that he grew up in. And, or the time that he grew up in, you know, and to kind of walk in his shoes was just hard, you know. It was hard to do that in front of an audience. And when I would start that first scene with Nathan, where he's on the phone and stuff, it's like, I mean, it's such an incredible, I mean, if you would have told me when I was in high school that I would be on stage on Broadway with Nathan Lane, I would be like, you've got to be kidding me. But I would get to start that, you know, that big marathon with him, you know, every day. But then, you know, you do the first 4-hour play, go away for dinner, and then come back, and I would end the play, you know, kissing his ghost. And you just felt like, God, we've been through war together. And it's not just us, the actors on stage, but everyone in that audience too. Because every show is different. Every show, you know, turns in a different way. The audience acts different. You know, you're different. The other actors are different. It was hard, but I learned about life in a way that I've, you know. But that's, you know, a great piece of writing like Tony wrote. I mean, there's just, I've been thinking about that play since high school.
So to get
So to get the chance to play that character in it was, I did not know how hard it was going to be, I tell you that.
How important is it as a queer man to tell those stories?
I mean, it's personally, I feel like I learned about myself in ways that I didn't, like you just don't, you don't get the, you know, you walk in your own shoes in life, you know, and I've always felt very safe, you know. I was in the drama department in high school. I went to Juilliard. It's like, to be queer, I mean, and you know, it's like I've been playing queer characters. My first movie, I played a trans character. So it's like I've never felt the danger of that, you know? So to walk in the shoes of someone who the danger is so real that he can't utter it, it taught me something about myself and about that, about my community, you know? That it's like, we're not all so lucky to be, to get the free pass in life. We're not.
No. Now politics, there are politicians who are using us as a scapegoat.
Yeah.
Are using us as, you know, a political division.
Yeah, and also as a community, we can be very unkind to each other, I feel like. You know, it's a very judgmental and kind of look at someone and be like, well, you know, you ought to have done it like this and stuff. And that's just not, you know, there's a more gentle way to be. You know, and I guess before I'd played Joe, I could look at that character on the page and think, you know, what a coward and stuff. But after playing him, I don't see a coward.
He had a journey.
I see someone who did something that was very, very hard to do, and something that most queer people do.
Right.
You know, have to figure out how to shed their skin.
Right, and in a different time, and also a different time. I mean, just a completely different time. You know, it's the beginning of the epidemic.
Yeah.
What gay man was going to run around and say, look, I'm gay? It was very few and far between.
Oh, I tell you, I got chills again just thinking about it. It's like that, it's that play was like a lesson in life, you know?
It was so beautifully done.
Yeah, it was a privilege to be a part of it.
So what do you want to do next? Do you want to work with your neighbor, Jessica Lange, that interview?
I would die to work with Jessica. Oh my God, I would love.
Did you ever think you'd be neighbors with Jessica Lange?
No. Oh, talk about one of the most inspiring, coolest people I've ever had the chance to meet. I mean, she was so good to me when I was building that house across the field.
I love
this
story.
She must have thought I was insane.
Well, I love this story you told about the coyote coming up to your tent. Yeah. My husband and I, we lived in Sherman Oaks. Okay, not the country, but to me, a city boy, that's the country. And this comes back to Twilight, actually. So I'm in our kitchen, and we have two dogs, and they're going nuts. And I look outside, and there are coyotes. But I don't know what coyotes are. I thought they were wolves. So I call my husband. I'm like, oh, my God, it's the wolves from Twilight. They're in the backyard. They look
lucky
like the
us.
Wolves. And he's like, Mark, they're coyotes.
Coyotes are very clever. I see them a lot now. Yeah, I always think it's kind of a lucky thing to see. There was one time I don't know if this was in the story. I know I told the story when I was talking to Jessica. I went to the farm one time in the middle of winter, and on one of the ponds there was just this huge bloody mess. This doe had.
Yeah, you tell. Keep going, but tell me.
It did. No, it did. I guess just the coyotes had chased it out onto the ice, and. She slipped and fell, and they just tore to pieces.
Yeah, we have two little white dogs. We were like, one of the reasons we moved to the valley was to have a backyard to let the dogs out. And as soon as we took, there were people on our street who were walking their dogs with tasers, billy clubs.
Really?
Yes, because the coyotes, they're fearless now.
Yeah, well, they will be. And they'll do this thing where they'll send a bitch in heat out to the houses to kind of yip and call dogs to come out to the... Come out. Wow. Come be with us. We're having so much fun out here in the woods.
So what is next for you? What should we look forward to? More stage, TV, movies? What do you want to do?
I don't know. I'm kind of...
More Ronin?
Looking for something interesting to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of where my head is right now.
How often are you reading scripts?
All the time. I mean, I'm looking hard to do something.
You like TV?
I do. I like the opportunity to get to tell a story over a long chunk of time.
And there's so many more options now. I mean,
yeah.
Streamers, it's every day I'm getting a tip sheet or a press release about a show, and it's like, it's in its third season. I'm like, I didn't even hear of this thing,
season. I know it, and they're so interesting. Are you watching Euphoria?
Yes.
Isn't it phenomenal?
Yes. It's intense.
It's intense, but I'm watching this and I'm just thinking, not only is it gorgeous and the music is incredible and every single one of those performances is just pitch perfect. Me and Matt saw Maddie at a restaurant in Venice yesterday.
So Maddie.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, Matt's my boyfriend.
Okay.
We saw Maddie, the actress who plays Maddie at a restaurant. And Maddie's one of my favorite characters on the show.
Oh, right. So did you fanboy? What do you do?
I was too nervous to. I'm too shy. But I definitely was like, there she is. I think that show is so, so good.
What else are you watching?
When They See Us, I thought was fantastic. But Chernobyl. I thought was
I haven't watched
exquisite.
It yet, and everyone says just really intense. Like, you got to be in a certain mood.
I hear that. But it's so stylish. Yeah. It's so incredibly stylish and so smart. I mean, it's about a science that I know nothing about, and I love that kind of thing. So to hear it explained in a dramatic way, I was like, "This is fascinating. This is fascinating." And it shows a kind of level of heroism that is not glorified. Just the way people were dealing with that disaster. It just told all of these small stories of individuals rising to the occasion, you know, when there was shit going down.
Mr. Lee Pace, you're amazing. Thank you so much. This was awesome. This was great.
I appreciate it.
That was Lee Pace. Thanks for listening to The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Coming up next week, Milo Ventimiglia, the Emmy-nominated star of This Is Us, stops by to talk about his new movie, The Art of Racing in the Rain, and so much more. In the meantime, make sure to follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mark Malkin. See you next week.